Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for all GOC-registered optometrists. With case studies and in-depth conversations each month, we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This month, we'll be looking at presbyopia. As it's a condition that comes on with ageing, presbyopia is something that we encounter in practice all the time. For most people who develop the condition, their eyesight is easily corrected with spectacles and sometimes contact lenses. But many patients seek to reduce or eliminate their dependency on spectacles, and that's when more advanced solutions are needed. In this episode, we'll look at what patients can do from two different treatment perspectives: laser vision correction and refractive lens exchange. Later on, Amir Hamid, a consultant ophthalmologist, will provide his tips to enable you to give sound advice on the next steps for patients who are looking for a surgical solution to presbyopia.
The technology is there, the technology is great, but you really do still have to tailor your solution in terms of the type of option that you will choose together with your patient.
And finally, optometrist Sandeep Vaswani will help us to understand how presbyopia management treatments will affect our day-to-day optometric examinations.
In refractive surgery, we often hear the term 20-happy rather than 20-20. It can be different for everyone, so as long as they are happy, that's the most important thing.
First, let's consider refractive laser surgery.
So I had been very successful contact lens wearer for a number of years.
Claire O'Donnell is a professor of optometry at the University of Manchester, and she's the head of eye sciences at Optegra. Claire knows this topic as an expert, but also through her own experience of presbyopia.
So I was relatively close to emmetropia until I developed some manifest hyperopia, which meant initially I started wearing reading glasses, which was fine, became more dependent on those, and then developed some issues with my distance vision. Contact lenses seemed the right way to go for me. I wasn't used to having specs on, and they worked well for a while. But really, the problems that I had, they were really to do with dry eye issues. So my lenses were becoming deposited, and that can completely wipe out either your distance vision or your near vision, depending on which eyes get the smeary vision on that day. So there were some mornings where by lunchtime I'd changed the lenses two or three times. The other issue that I had with contact lenses, and I'm almost ashamed to say this, is I wasn't terribly compliant. So I do like to go for a bit of a swim, swimming with my contact lenses now and again, occasionally falling asleep with them. In fairness, you know, I was travelling a lot, and my busy lifestyle just kind of led me to the conclusion that I need to be a bit sensible here, and, you know, I really don't want to go back to wearing specs. So what are the alternatives? And since I worked in a company that offered laser vision correction and refractive lensectomy, you know, naturally I started to explore those in terms of whether they were the right solution for me as a potential patient.
And just thinking about these surgical options, there's more than one. So what treatment options were you seriously thinking about?
So I was looking at laser vision correction and refractive lens exchange, refractive lensectomy, or clear lens exchanges, as some listeners might more commonly know those solution terms.
And how did you decide on the option that was right for you? Is this where your privileged knowledge came into play?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I went for an initial consultation after having done my own research, like, you know, many people do. Looked at the solution that was least invasive. So because I had been used to using monovision, and that optically worked really well for me, I knew that I could tolerate monovision. So the Presbyon solution was perfect. The other thing that made me sway towards laser vision correction rather than a lens-based solution was my crystalline lens was pretty clear. I really had virtually no signs of cataract. So had it been different, if I had sort of moderate lens opacities, I probably would have been advised to and would have wanted to choose a lens-based solution.
And you've mentioned presbyond, which is a very specific treatment profile. So, what's the difference between presbyond and other forms of presbyopic LASIK solutions?
Yeah, so I think most listeners will be familiar with the concept of monovision LASIK. So monovision, typically what we're doing is targeting, the dominant eye for distance and the non-dominant eye for near. And that can work really well for people. It did for me in contact lenses for many years. But I guess the downside of that is there tends to be a bit of a compromise for mid-range vision, doesn't there? So intermediate vision might not be quite there. So with presbyond, the idea is that you have what you call a blended laser vision approach. So the dominant eye is typically targeted for distance and mid-range, and the non-dominant eye is targeted for near and mid-range, so that when both eyes are open together, you don't have that gap in the middle for intermediate. And it does that by modulating the spherical aberrations within the eye. So it's a combination of a sort of modified mini monovision approach with LASIK. And again, the LASIK platform has been around for decades. It's well understood, safe, and efficacious.
And for you, do you feel that that approach is more reassuring for patients that might be worried about nighttime glare? Because there are multifocal laser platforms out there as well, aren't there?
That's absolutely true, and that is also a consideration. And I think I really didn't want to compromise my corrected distance visual acuity, if that makes sense. So one of the things that we often counsel patients on is that, you've got a monovision solution there. But, if there are any challenging visual demands that need to be met, so for example, if I go for a long drive at night on the motorway in poor viewing conditions, I have a pair of relatively inexpensive driving glasses, so I can top up my near eye, and the quality of vision for distance then is restored to pretty much what it was pre-surgery. So that for me was a reassurance as well. So those top up driving specs, if you like, stay in my glove compartment. But in truth, Michelle, I've probably used those maybe half a dozen times since I got them.
So clearly the treatment has worked really well for you, and you've described the improvement in your vision, which has resulted in you being pretty much spectacle independent. Are there any implications if your vision continues to change? Say, for example, I'm thinking about cataract or advancing presbyopia.
So, yeah, I did think, well, you know what? I'm presbyopic now, and I could have refractive lensectomy, which means that, I'm not going to develop clinically significant cataracts later in life. So maybe I should look at a lens-based solution. But then I thought about it. Well, I've had the presbyon treatment profile. So I have got that enhanced depth of focus ablation profile in my cornea to give me that enhanced good intermediate functionality. So if I do need to have cataracts treated in the future, what I would have most likely is monofocal intraocular lenses and a monovision solution, and I will retain that blended approach to my mid-range and near.
So, Claire, in your role, you look at the outcomes for these sorts of treatments across the whole country. Is a successful outcome like yours typical for most patients?
Yeah, we look at a number of different outcomes for the procedures that we offer, and one of them is the patient reported outcomes or patient satisfaction. And patient satisfaction levels have been really encouragingly high with presbyond. We have nowadays a number of fantastic options for patients, and really the key thing is to listen really carefully to what the patients are seeking to achieve, and have a really open and honest conversation about the expected outcomes, so that you are truly offering tailor-made solutions. In other words, the right offering to the right patient at the right time in their ocular journey.
Claire, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. If you've got a topic that you'd like us to cover or a particularly interesting case you'd like to share, email us. The address is podcast@dockets.info or use LinkedIn to message us here at Docket. Next, let's look at an alternative surgical intervention for presbyopia, refractive lens exchange. To guide me through this, I'm joined by Amir Hamid. Amir is a consultant ophthalmic surgeon and the medical director for Optegra in the UK. Thanks for joining me, Amir.
It's a pleasure.
So we just heard about presbyopic LASIK with Claire O'Donnell, and we know that it's had a really positive impact on patients because we have positive patient-reported outcomes. But what are the options for patients that are not suitable for presbyopic laser treatment?
Well, the great thing is that there are multiple options now available, and I can divide them into phakic solutions or pseudophakic solutions. For example, solutions where we leave the patient's lens intact, or solutions where we have to remove and replace the patient's lenses. And we can do that with a variety of different types of lenses that we place in the eye. So if I start with the phakic solution, so if you're a younger patient who is outside the range of presbyopic laser vision correction, we can implant a lens on top of your own lens, either with a monovision approach, or we have extended depth of focus phakic IOLs and multifocal phakic IOLs as well.
So most optometrists that are listening to this will be very familiar with the concept of monovision because they fit contact lenses along those lines as well. Can you talk us through how the mini monovision works, the extended depth of focus, that kind of thing?
So there's two strategies. In terms of extended depth of focus, the optics of the lens can either utilize spherical aberration, either positive or negative. So we've always been taught that spherical aberration is bad, but as long as we don't go above a certain amount of spherical aberration, the brain is able to tolerate it very well. Visual quality is still maintained. So you're extending the depth of focus and you're combining it with less defocus in your monovision eye. So you don't have to be -2, you know, even -1.5. You can be less than that. And because there's an extended depth of focus, the difference in the focal range between the two eyes is blended in the middle. So with traditional monovision, often, particularly in patients who have lost a lot of their accommodation, there's a gap in their intermediate vision. So by having a sort of a blended approach in the intermediate vision, they have a much higher range of vision, which is very high quality.
When is a true multifocal a better option? Because what you've described seems very good for the younger patient who isn't, you know, very presbyopic yet. But when is it that a true multifocal option is better for the patient?
Yeah, and you know, there's also a group of patients that cannot tolerate any difference between the two eyes, so they can't tolerate any monovision. And they also really like the ability to not have any dissociation and to maintain that binocular vision between the two eyes. Those patients would do well with a multifocal lens because you get the same focal range with the two eyes. Now, as with any presbyopic solution, there are some compromises. So with a multifocal lens, patients need to understand that there is a possibility that there is a reduction in contrast. There is also the possibility of glare and halos, particularly in the evenings with oncoming car headlights and streetlights. So there's really a wide range of solutions, and multifocal lenses work well in patients who are suitable for it.
I guess it's a case of really explaining to the patients what the options are and what the pros and cons of those options are, and relating those pros and cons to their visual demands so they then understand what option is best suited to them and what they can therefore expect should they go for that option.
Absolutely. So, you know, things like how old they are, what occupation they have, what their hobbies are, what their visual demands are, you know, do they live in the city, or do they have to drive in dark country lanes at night. So it's really quite an in-depth discussion. It's not just about the technology. The technology is there, the technology is great, but you really do still have to tailor your solution in terms of the type of option that you will choose together with your patient.
And do you think there's a certain personality type who is most suitable for these types of lenses? So for example, EDOF versus a multifocal?
There is a degree of requiring some neuroadaptation, you know, whether you go with a monovision solution, whether you use multifocal contact lenses, whether you use multifocal intraocular lenses. There is a period of time where patients will have to allow their own brain to take over without overanalyzing everything that they're experiencing.
And again, the other thing about expectations, it's not just the actual process, it's the duration of the process as well. So the period of neuroadaptation can be very variable as well, can't it?
Absolutely.
When I see patients having had surgery and they are not adapting particularly well in the early days, I always want to reassure them. One of my colleagues uses a phrase that I really like, and she said, well, you have to appreciate, she said to the patient, that your recovery is in baby steps. You can't expect to run straight away.
Yeah, I'll take that on board, Michelle. Thank you very much. You learn something new every day.
So we've talked about the patient type who might be coming through the door, the lens options that are available, the modalities that might be available in terms of optics. How do you advise them in terms of weighing up the advantages and disadvantages of having a lens exchange procedure and indeed of different types of lens implants?
The general rule is I always say, look, what I'm trying to do is improve your visual performance without spectacles. I can never guarantee 100% of the time you won't need glasses for every single task that you need to do. And, you know, there, unfortunately, there's no free lunch. So if you have the best level of visual quality, your spectacle dependence is very, very high. And then if you have highest degree of spectacle independence, there will be a trade-off in visual quality because there will be some loss of contrast. There will be some potential for night vision issues to achieve that. So those are the things that I go through. It's very important to go through that process. What is particularly important, I think, like you say, is that the patient understands these elements and they say, look, you're the expert, make the decision for me. That is not my role. My role is to give them all the information that they require to make an informed choice. Of course, you can guide them. And of course, you can tell patients when they're not suitable or it's unsafe to proceed. So that's my general rule.
And in terms of outcomes for patients who undergo refractive or clear lens exchange, how successful does it tend to be broadly? How often are patients spectacle independent?
The spectacle independence range, depending on the procedure or the lens type that we use, is often in the range of about 85 to 95%. But there will be times when you may need an optical solution. For example, you know, if you're trying to thread a needle or if you're trying to read the very, very tiny print, I mean, those leaflets that you get with your new medication from the pharmacy. So that's always a possibility, and we explain that to our patients.
Amir, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michelle, for the very kind invitation. Thank you.
Finally, I wanted to understand how all of this applies to our day-to-day practice. So joining me now is Sandeep Vaswani. Sandeep is a refractive optometrist and does pre- and post-operative management for laser vision correction patients and intraocular surgery patients. Thanks for joining me, Sandeep.
Yeah, hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me on this podcast.
So, Sandeep, when a patient attends for an eye examination with their own optometrist having had presbyopic laser correction or lens surgery, what is the first thing that needs to be established?
Yeah, so the first thing to bear in mind is the refractive targets. So for monovision or presbyon, one eye will be targeted for plano, which is usually the dominant eye, and the other eye is targeted for no more than minus 150. And this is to ensure that the patients tolerate the degree of anisometropia.
And of course, for multifocal LASIK or intraocular lenses, the refractive target is usually emmetropia. So let's just start with measuring vision. What I found when examining patients that have had a multifocal IOL or any kind of presbyopic surgery, sometimes you need to give them a little bit more time when you're measuring their acuity because they start looking at the vision chart and they might think they can't see it, then as they're reading, they suddenly become aware that actually they can see it and their vision is improving as their brains start to process the information. So I think it's all about giving the patient a bit more time, because if you don't have the correct unaided acuity to start with, then you'll be starting off with the wrong information.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely a valid point. I mean, dry eyes is often a common side effect as well with, you know, lens or laser surgery. So if you feel like the vision is fluctuating during refraction, give them more time, ask them to blink to try and stabilize their tear film when taking those measurements. So that's also a very important point.
If a patient isn't completely happy with their vision, what have you found are the common complaints?
These procedures can reduce or eliminate the need for glasses altogether, but the adaptation process can last on average about 3 to 4 months, and sometimes can be even as long as a year. And during the adaptation period, patients may experience ghosting or blurring, usually at distance, whereby the near eye is interfering with the overall binocular distance vision. And this is referred to as cross blur. And cross blur can also result in visual fluctuations. But over time, the brain will become accustomed to this format and the distance vision will usually sharpen and stabilize with neuroadaptation. In the early period, optometrists need to bear in mind that some glare or night vision symptoms may also be present. And again, this is due to the corneal healing and cross blur, but fades with adaptation and time.
And it's not just about the distance vision. Sometimes patients might be struggling with their near vision or their intermediate vision as well. And that's very important as well, isn't it?
It can. So I think two things to bear in mind when we're dealing with presbyopic IOL patients is the first thing is lighting. So patients often state that they require more lighting at near, and reading tends to be harder in dimmer lighting conditions. This is just due to the way the lens is designed and the splitting of light for distance, intermediate, and near. So it's just about counseling these patients and just advising them to increase the light on these occasions and their near vision will improve. So for example, if they're at home and they're reading a book, you know, you just have a lamp or a light source at the back that's illuminating onto the page and their vision will be much sharper. This is very normal. And the other thing is the working distances. So sometimes patients who come in and have little or no refractive error post IOL surgery, they may say that their computer vision or their near vision isn't as good as they hoped. And often this is simply just due to the working distance. So their habitual working distance for reading and computer use may be different to the optimal working distance of the lens. So simply just adjusting this by either moving the screen forward or back, or the book or magazine forward or back, can improve the near and the intermediate vision significantly.
It's very similar to presbyopic contact lenses in that sense. I remember Neil Retallick saying in this context, lighting is your friend.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's one of the best things to easily elevate the vision.
And when it comes to the refraction element of the eye examination, is there anything in particular that optometrists should remember?
For presbyopic intraocular lens patients, optometrists will usually encounter sort of monovision monofocal IOLs or extended depth of focus IOLs or multifocal IOLs. It's important to bear in mind that the autorefraction isn't very accurate for extended depth of focus IOLs or multifocal IOLs. Because, you know, especially with the multifocal IOLs, there's different zones. As an example, a patient could be 6.6 or 6.5 and the autorefractive may be showing a minus 1.5 because it's reading more through the near part of the lens. So for the refraction element in particular, it's best to obviously check the visual acuity and have an informed idea of how much prescription may be there to begin with. And when doing that, obviously rely on your own subjective refraction skills.
And so when you do start your refraction, we're not strictly speaking pushing the plus because there is no accommodation, but you do have to remember to give them as much plus as possible, because if you don't, the patient will start using the wrong part of the multifocal lens, perhaps the intermediate section, for example, even though they're looking in the distance. So because patients can drift between the different zones of the lens, it's important to make sure you offer the maximum plus and are careful not to over minus in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, if you are doing a refraction and if you are giving a prescription for multifocal IOL patients, they're never going to need more than one prescription. So they wouldn't need a separate distance or a separate near. It's usually one prescription. So, you know, if they're complaining of their near, they might be a bit hyperopic. If they're complaining of their distance, they might be a bit myopic. But it usually is not going to require two separate sets of prescriptions because you already have that multifocal element in the lens. So it's usually just about a singular residual refractive error if there is one present.
So another issue that can cause visual difficulties with patients is posterior capsular opacification. And refractive surgery patients do seem to be more sensitive to this, even if there's only a minor amount. Why do you think this is?
Yes, I mean, with a multifocal IOL, for example, you know, the lens has multiple prescriptions and it splits the light for distance, intermediate, and near. So any posterior capsular opacification could be a bit more impactful in these kinds of patients. Generally speaking, try and gauge the extent of the symptoms and whether there's any actual impact on the best corrected visual acuity.
Yes. In terms of communicating with patients that have had refractive surgery and are now coming in for their routine eye examination, how do you think optometrists should relay the fact that they found a prescription to improve vision when the patient perhaps might not even be symptomatic, may not be struggling, and obviously the patient would have been aiming for spectacle independence with their surgery. So, is there anything that the optometrist needs to bear in mind?
With regards to prescriptions, I mean, this can sometimes change over time, or it could be influenced by certain factors, like PCO, for example. With laser eye surgery, you know, if any prescriptions down the line are found and it's sort of a year or two later, then this is likely due to perhaps some regression that's occurred. But it's important to understand how impactful these prescriptions may be. Because, you know, if patients have good visual acuity and, for example, the prescription is just taking them from 6.6 to 6.4, you know, is it something that they require a correction for? But if you don't know the cause, then it's always worthwhile just sort of referring back to the treating clinic if you want some more advice. But try to speak to patients, obviously, within your scope of practice.
I think it's also important for optometrists not to dwell on small residual prescriptions. A zero prescription isn't necessary for a happy patient, and a small refractive error is insignificant if the patient can see what they need to see.
Absolutely. I mean, we in refractive surgery, we often hear the term 20 happy rather than 20/20, because as you said, every patient has, you know, different expectations, and it's not like you need to sort of aim for a certain target in terms of visual acuity because it can be different for everyone. So as long as they are happy, that that's the most important thing.
Okay, thank you very much, Sandeep.
Thanks, Michelle. Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Don't forget that if you head to dockets.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. And by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point, covering communication and clinical practice. Sound Optometry will be back again next month, so make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss out. The producers are Jason Hoskin and Dr. Hilary Guite. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.